The 13th chapter of Matthew is a chapter that contains a number of parables. We had an opportunity, as we studied a couple of weeks ago, to look at the parable of the sower. That's basically the only parable that we looked at in the text. So we're going to spend the remainder of our time today finishing up that chapter. And we handed out chapter 14's handouts 2 weeks ago. If anyone doesn't have a copy of that, we can get it to you after the class is over with. But I just wanted to make note again of what that first parable stated and in concise form, and also look at verses 10 through 17 very quickly again, because we started off with that last time as a discussion of why it is that Jesus chose to speak in parables. So the parable of the sower, as you will remember, has certain things that were certain attributes or aspects of it that were the same. We talk about constants and variables. The constant is the sower and the word, the seed, and the variables are the soil. And in most parables, when they are presented, are presented for the purpose of establishing a single divine truth. I mean, it's not to say that you can't derive other lessons from it, but there are dangers if you try to go beyond and to try to be a bit more fanciful or far-reaching in your explanation of various aspects. I've heard some lessons that I was very uncomfortable with preached on parables, because every single detail was given to mean something, and I don't know that that's exactly the intent. There is a primary lesson that is established here in this. The different kinds of soil, I mentioned in verse 4, the wayside, the stony places, verse 5, the thorns, verse 7, and then good ground. So there's four different kinds of soil. And as Jesus explained the parable of the sower, we're very grateful for the fact that we have some explanations of his parables. It's very helpful to us. In verses 18 through 23, he establishes the constants that the sower, of course, is the one who is preaching the word. The seed itself is the gospel of the kingdom. And then the soil, it represents the different kinds of hearts of men. And so when you look at what happened in the sowing on that particular soil, you find some very simple and very powerful lessons. The soil that was sown on the wayside did not have an opportunity to germinate. The wicked one came and snatched it away. That's the one who received the soil, or received the seed by the wayside, having reference to a hard heart that the gospel doesn't penetrate. The second soil, that of the stony ground, it is indicated in verse 20, is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, but there is no root. And so it doesn't take long, because of tribulation or persecution, he stumbles. And so there is a lack of conviction. There is the seed germinating. It indicates a conversion, but no staying power. And it reminds me of the text in 2 Peter, where the various attributes that are to be developed in the Christian to become a mature Christian, the first one, after faith, add your faith, virtue. And that virtue is a courage of conviction is what's under consideration there. So a person who will stand up for what he believes in. And that was lacking in this individual. The third of the soils is he who receives seed among the thorns, verse 22 of the text. And this has reference to the problems of worldliness and temptation. The cares of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word and becomes unfruitful. And again, these illustrate principles that Jesus established very clearly in his teaching about how you cannot serve both God and mammon. That a divided loyalty for a Christian is something that is utterly destructive. So here again, you have an individual who heard the word and germinated in his heart, but there was something that kept it from bearing fruit. And then the good soil is found in verse 23 of the text. He receives seed on the good ground. Is he who hears the word and understands it, but indeed bears fruit and produces some hundredfold, some 60, and some 30. And of course, the point is, we want to be ourselves good soil, because that's the only option that is mentioned in this particular text that is acceptable these other end results, the wicked one snatching them away, an individual wilting under persecution, or an individual who's turned away because of the cares of life. Those are individuals who do not bear fruit for the Lord, and as such are not pleasing to Him. It is required not only that we believe, but that we be a particular type of believer, productive believer, an obedient believer, that we bear fruit for the Lord. And so it's a very simple lesson on discipleship, and it's something that we need to bear witness to and be very careful to heed ourselves. That's the lesson that's easy in the text as far as, or the easiest, because of, number one, it's explained, and we're fortunate that the parable of the wheat and tares is explained as well. But also the lesson itself is a simple one, which is why I think it's a favorite of so many. Anybody have any questions that they want to raise or comments that they want to make about the parable of the sower before we go on into new material? Yes, Dennis?
When I was young, I had a tendency to do that very thing that you talked about at the very first.
Yeah.
I wanted to squeeze everything I could out of the parables, and I was looking for things that weren't there. And you're right. Jesus' parables are very simple on the surface. That does not mean, however, though, that we can't take lessons from them in addition to what he what he said. Because we've got four different kinds of souls here. Two are failures and two are not, in that the thorny ground, the Christian still goes on and on. He just doesn't progress past that point. But what we can take away from this is the first one is not much you can do for him. Even though you sit down and tell him the truth, he just doesn't understand, he can't comprehend it. It's not the right time for him. Hopefully he can come back later and something will change. But there's really nothing you can do for him. But the second and the third, there are things that can be done. The thing about the stony ground is if you can anticipate with a new convert, and that's what we should do, we shouldn't leave our new converts to their own devices. Once we put all this energy into converting them, and now once they're converted, we leave them to their own resources. And what happens is if they were of the stony ground, then when tribulations come up and they fall away and they're not showing up the services, we've lost them. But if we're going to anticipate that with every new convert and keep that from happening, then we can move them to another category.
Yeah.
And same with the thorny ground. These are Christians who've been Christians for a long time, but they're not growing. So we should be doing something to move them to the other ground. Cultivate.
Yeah.
In other words, right?
Soul preparation, cultivation.
Definitely something we can take away.
Yeah, we need to make sure that we don't think from this is that individuals naturally fall in one of four categories, and that's unchangeable or
right.
Valuable.
Exactly.
It's certainly not. It's an indication as to what kind of heart we ought to have, and if there is something that is amiss there, we need to self-cultivate and certainly try to do better, but also to be mindful of others and their needs is certainly true. And again, principles that would be used to establish those truths are throughout Scripture. We need to edify one another, encourage one another, strengthen, even admonish one another from time to time in order to strengthen each other. So that's a good point to be made. Anybody else? All right, now you'll notice that it's actually this text is divided between verses 1 and 9, which is the parable itself, and then the explanation of the parable in verses 18 through 23. And the interpolation in between those two passages is a discussion that the disciples had with Jesus about why it was he was doing his teaching in this particular way. Now, we already talked about this a little bit, so I just wanted to note that this section in verses 10 through 17, when the disciples came and said, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" His answer, "Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. Forever it has, you know, to him more will be given, he will have abundance. But whoever does not have even what he has will be taken away from them. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, 'Hearing you will hear and not understand, seeing you will see and not perceive, for the hearts of this people have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing, their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts in turn, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, hear what you hear and did not hear it.'" So this is a good explanation given as to why the teaching was done as it was. But a couple of things to note in regard to this that we that we talked about 2 weeks ago, but I just want to emphasize, is that this is not a matter of inability to understand what is being taught. It is a matter of unwillingness. You'll notice that that is clearly stated in verse 15 with regard to the prophecy of Isaiah. The hearts of the people have grown dull, and their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand. So it's not that they cannot understand it, but simply that these messages are not something that they were willing to hear. And there was a differentiation that was made by our Lord on this occasion as a result of that. I wanted to read to you again just very clearly, very quickly, what McGarvey wrote on this. I thought it was a good paragraph. It said, the unbelieving Jew had, in common with the believers, the heavenly privilege of hearing Jesus and seeing his miracles. But unlike the believers, they hadn't the faith and the knowledge which they should have derived from these opportunities. These opportunities were now to be taken from them by a kind of teaching which they could not understand, which would not be explained to them. In general terms, the law is that to those who have made improvement by their opportunities, other opportunities will be given. But from him who has made no improvement, the opportunities themselves will be taken away. Just to understand and recognize that God does not compel men to come to him, that there has to be that desire on the part of an individual to turn to him. And in the face of unbelief, then these kinds of teachings are things that are not going to be understood and not going to be heeded or accepted by such individuals. But if an individual desires it and wants it and is willing to listen and willing to heed, then those things can be received. And that's where in verse 17 the passage states that there are prophets and righteous men who desire to see what you see. Righteous individuals are desiring to see these things. In 1 Peter 1:10, they talked about the salvation that the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, prophesied of the grace that would come to you. And this is what was being received by them. The teaching was so precious, and yet so many individuals were unwilling to listen to what was being said. And so that was the differentiation that was made by our Lord on that occasion with regard to the purpose of his preaching in these parables. All right, so those are the 2 points that we made in the latter part of our lesson last time we were together. Anybody have any questions or comments before we get into verse 24 in the parable of wheat and tares? All right, would someone then read to me verses 24, or read to us, verses 24 through 30 then? Somebody do that for me.
I'll read it. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the grain had sprouted and the produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? He said to them, an enemy has done this. The servants said to him, do you want us to then go and gather them up? But he said, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at that time of harvest, we'll say to the reapers, first gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.
Okay, so first of all, when it talks about the harvest, what's under consideration there? Judgment. Okay, so that's the language is pretty clear, isn't it? And of course, explanation will make that clear as well. Verse 30, they grow together until harvest. At the time of harvest, there's two possibilities. Bind together the tares and burn them and gather the wheat into my barn. So very similar language to that with regard to judgment. Those who are ungodly will be cast away into outer darkness, and those who are righteous will be gathered together to be with him forever. So this is a lesson concerning that final day of judgment. The harvest is indicative of judgment. But it also, there are some interesting things about this this parable that we want to address. And the first is the idea of the tares as being indistinguishable from the wheat. You'll notice the statement there that what happened was, while men were sleeping, the enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat. So when we're talking about this situation, we've got a situation where you've got those that are wheat and those that are tares, and at some point in time, is not a way of distinguishing between them. This actually is a an illustration that Jesus uses based upon reality, as all parables are. There's some kernel of reality or common sense that's involved with regard to the parables that Jesus uses. And the tare was a plant that was, until such time as harvest came, virtually indistinguishable, until the head of the wheat formed. So there was the stalk that came to the head. Until that happened, you couldn't tell the difference between the two. And so it was something that actually was done. This is a scenario that they would be familiar with. In fact, in the study that I did on this particular lesson, I came across some information that it was a common enough form of sabotage that was done in Rome or in that region at that time, is that there was actually Roman law that outlined a punishment for those who were guilty of the practice of sowing tares in another man's field of wheat. So it could be a very destructive thing, and it's something that nothing could be done about. I mean, if you tried to get the tares out, you're going to put the wheat as well. And so it was a very destructive thing that was done. And so there were laws that were actually in place and punishments that were in place as a result of that. So when we look at, though, the explanation of the parable of wheat and tares, you'll notice, again, it's divided up. It's down in verse 36. So if you'll go down to verse 36, let's go ahead and let Jesus describe this lesson, what he was intending from this lesson himself. Go from verse 36 through 43. We're told that Jesus sent the multitude away, went to his house. His disciples came to him, saying, "Explain to us the parable of the tares of the field." And he answered and said to them, "He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom. The tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels. They will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and all those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear." And so it's a pretty simple thing to establish the truths that are found in here, because he goes right down the line in very concise fashion and establishes each point. So starting off with this in verse 37 of the text, "He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man." Now, the word or phrase "Son of Man" is used often to refer to Jesus himself. And I think that here the indication is, again, as these are lessons or parables on the kingdom. And the verse 19 back in the parable of the sower explained, it said, when anyone hears the word of the kingdom, this is the word that comes from the Son of Man. It originates from Jesus Christ. And so we're talking about the words of salvation that are here. And so what does the word of the Son of Man do? And he brings his gospel for the purpose of saving the world. But he has an opponent, one who is his opposite, an enemy, as stated in verse 39. The enemy who sowed the tares, the sons of the wicked one, he's the devil. And so this is the idea, is he sows, the Son of Man sows the good seed. The good seed are the sons of the kingdom. It's a little bit different from the parable of the sower, because the parable of the sower, the seed's the word, where we're told that in this case the seed is the son of the sons of the kingdom, that is those who respond to the word. But this is what is the ultimate fruit that is born from the efforts of the Son of Man. Jesus came to seek and to save those who are lost. Those who are his are saved. But you have the one in opposition who's trying to sow discord, and his fruit of the things that he has sown are the sons of the wicked one. So there's the contrast in the world. So what we're talking about is all mankind. We're talking about those who are righteous and stand before God, and those who are unrighteous. And so it's a very simple illustration that is given. So you've got Jesus, you've got the devil, you've got the efforts of Jesus which brings salvation, you've got the efforts of the devil which brings condemnation, and in that day of judgment, there will be that determination as to whether or not you are a wheat plant or a terebinth? Which are you? Are you a son of the kingdom or are you a son of the wicked one? And in that day, that final determination will be made is when the separation will take place. So this is a very clear, very obvious and simple picture of the nature of the judgment. And so the only thing I would like to add to that is in verses 41 through 43, as the lesson is driven home, we are told that in that day, that all things that offend those who practice lawlessness will be cast into the furnace of fire. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, you'll remember, he said it's a righteous thing with God to visit indignation and wrath upon those who are disobedient. It is as it must be. Those who offend will be cast away. And that casting away, as described in Scripture again and again, is an eternal condemnation in hellfire. An ending, there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then in contrast to that, in verse 43, the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. So there is that concept of reconciliation and rejoicing that comes for those who are righteous. Very simple, again, a very simple parable when it's explained. It may be that as they were listening to it, they were thinking, well, what is he talking about? But when he explained it, it made it very, very clear. Now, those are the only two that we've got in this chapter that have been explained by Jesus himself. So we're going to have to put on the thinking caps with regard to the others. Yes, Dick.
Yeah. As we say, the I shouldn't have cleared my throat before I put up my hand. You know, see that the field of the world, and I can see today, you know, the same thing of the righteous and the unrighteous. And so they just let them go together. But this doesn't apply to the church, though. Of course, I'm not saying you are or anything like that. But in the church, we put those unrighteous out of the church. You know, and the Christian falls away in that.
Yeah, this is a picture of humanity, is what it
right.
is. And humanity falls into two classes, those who are saved and those who are lost. But the fact is that it is appointed for man to die once, and after this, the judgment. And it is in that final day of judgment that the reckoning comes, and that's what the picture is establishing for us. Anybody else about any of this? All right, then, that means that we are in the next section, which begins in verse, I've been skipping back and forth, but the next parable is in verses 31 and 32, the parable of the mustard seed. And actually, in the... I forget the name. I think his name is Pope. That in the Truth commentary, he made the note that there are some what he refers to as a double parable construct that are found in this particular text. It's kind of an interesting thing that you have two parables. Actually, it happens three times in this passage. The parable of mustard seed, the parable of leaven, teach basically two parables teaching the same major point. And then as you go down to the parable of the hidden treasures and the parable of the pearl of great price in verses 44 through 46, you have two parables that are teaching basically the same principle, same major point. And then the third time, it's separated, the parable of the tares and then the parable of the dragnet in verses 47 through 52 also teach basically the same lesson. So his view was that the double parable construct is something that was used to basically redouble or emphasize the point that he wanted to make. And so these are very simple parables. They're very simple, which is why they're very short. But they teach us at least one important truth with regard to the kingdom. So the first one is in verses 31 and 32, the parable of the mustard seed. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of the seeds, but when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." And notice the similarity to verse 33, the parable of leaven. Another parable he spoke to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal, until it was all leavened." So what you see in both of these parables is the idea of expansion, of growth, in both the parables. So with regard to the parable of the mustard seed, I've seen pictures of a mustard bush, and the seed's a very small seed, but it becomes a very large tree-like structure. And that's the point that is being made. When you see something as tiny as the seed, but to recognize what it becomes, that it's large enough so that even the birds can nest in the branches of this structure, in this big bush or this tree, that indicates the nature of that kind of growth. And so when we talk about that, you know, we can emphasize the power of the kingdom as the seed, the gospel of the kingdom as the seed, to expand the kingdom, that great changes can come from very small beginnings. I think that it teaches us a very important lesson about how we can trust in the power of the gospel. I think that so often that people today, religious people in general, do not have that confidence in the word that they ought to have. And so they want to try to add something to it, or to utilize something else in addition to it, or to substitute something for it, because they're not seeing, or they don't trust that there will be sufficient growth. But the power of God unto salvation is the gospel of Christ. It alone has that ability, and it is the method that God has chosen to save the world, through the preaching of truth, the planting of the seed. And when it is planted, it brings forth fruit. We are given that promise by Paul, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, when he said that he had planted and Apollos had watered, but God gives the increase. And praises to be given to God because of how effective his measures are in that, in the proclamation of those things. So that's I think, the primary point to be made. And, of course, the parable of the leaven does basically the same thing. Is that if we trust in the power of the gospel to accomplish what is needed, it would be like a woman who puts the leaven. And I remember when Debbie and I got a bread maker. You know, I never had an interest in making bread, but I did like to use the bread maker. So at that point in time, I would put the leaven in, and it's this little small spoonful of these little, I guess, is it seeds? I guess they're seeds, and you drop them in and the bread rises, and that little chunk of bread becomes a big loaf, and a big fluffy loaf. And it's kind of a neat thing to know that little leavening influence is what brought that about. And without it, we would have the crackers that we have on the Lord's table on Sunday morning, but with it, you have this big fluffy loaf. So it causes the expanse. And so it's something that they would be very familiar with. They used leaven, of course, in their cooking, and so they would know about the influence of what was accomplished by it. These are these same plain, simple lessons which illustrate a very important point. And the very important point is the seed of the gospel and the preaching of the kingdom is something that can bring such wonderful results, such expanse, such growth. And that's an important lesson for us to learn and to know and accept. Yes, Dick.
Yeah, as to the mustard seed, we can see that on the first gospel sermon ever preached by the 11 and 12 apostles on the day of Pentecost. 3,000 souls in one day, you know, I mean, in that. I mean, this the first time it was preached in 3,000 in one day.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
That's an amazing example of it, yeah. And, you know, we sometimes, I think, can come somewhat discouraged, but because we don't see those kinds of results today. I've talked with individuals who are older who would tell me about times when the gospel was preached in extended meetings, and there'd be 40 and 50 or 100 people baptized. I do want you to know that still happens. It's we've got a little bit of a problem in our society with regard to the secularism and the misunderstandings about what religion is. But there are places in the world where the gospel still has that effect, and where individuals are baptized quite often. And extensive opportunities. So there are times when there's more wayside soil. There are times when there's more stony soil, and certainly times when the cares of the world can choke out the faith in people's lives. But there are still plenty of hearts among us, even in our society, in our time, that would respond well to the preaching of the gospel. That's the reason why you're here. And we all need to kind of keep in mind that we're not all that special. I mean, we're just if we have come to a knowledge of truth and accepted it and have made it our own, that there's no reason why our neighbors and our friends and our family cannot as well. And we should never despair. We should continue to proclaim that gospel, because when it falls upon good hearts, this is what happens. There's nothing wrong with the seed. Never has been, never will be. And the only thing that precludes it from growing is when the heart's not as it should be. But if the heart's right, it's going to expand the kingdom. And that's a good lesson for us to learn. All right? Anybody else? Okay. All right, so we're covering this pretty quickly. I want you to note just very quickly a little insert that is found in verses 34 and 35. We're told that all these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables and utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. There's some significance to that statement. It's a reference to Psalm 78. This is a prophecy concerning the Messiah. It's a messianic prophecy. And one of the things to keep in mind is that Jesus, in his ministry, fulfilled all of the prophecies concerning the Messiah. This is important because of two things. Number one, it identifies him as the Messiah. But secondly, it serves as proof to us that he is indeed the one that he self-identified as. In other words, it serves as evidence to us. Some of those things he did so purposefully to fulfill the prophecies. This was God's will. Other things were done to him, and I think even more compelling with regard to the evidence is the fact that he was born of a virgin, that he was hung on a tree, those kinds of things that were done to him in fulfillment of prophecy. When he was mocked and his tunic was divided, those kinds of things are referred to in Scripture. And it wasn't something that he necessarily chose to do, but was done to him, which indicates again that he was the one that had been prophesied. But on this particular occasion, Jesus knew it was his purpose in his teaching, to teach in parables, that was intended, that it had been prophesied, and he did it so that it would be fulfilled, what was spoken by the prophet, that he would open his mouth in parables and utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. It indicates again the purpose and the reason behind it, in addition to what he told them earlier. But it also indicates the nature of the revelation. These are things that were newly revealed. This is the gospel of the kingdom that is at the first beginning to be spoken. And so it is a significant thing in that regard. Any questions about verses 34 and 35? We want to add to that. All right. Okay, so then that gets us down to the second set of double parables, which is the parable of the hidden treasure in verse 44. And the pearl of great price in verses 45 and 46. So in this parable, a different lesson about the kingdom is taught, one that is also important. Again, the kingdom of heaven, verse 44, is like a treasure that is hidden in the field, which a man found and hid, and for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has, and he buys that field. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Now, there are some differences in these two parables. The difference is, in the first one, he stumbles across the treasure that is hidden in the field. And the second is he is seeking for this pearl of great price. And so there maybe is a difference. One of the commentators that I came across said, some never looking for the kingdom stumble across it, but recognize its value and embrace it. Which is why it's so important for us to always shine our lights before men, so that if they, so fortunate that I ran across you and I saw this example or had opportunity to hear this teaching, because it's not something I was looking for. Whereas others are actually seeking after the kingdom. But the important and primary point, these parables illustrate a desire to possess something that is of great value. And so it teaches, number one, the value of the kingdom, how important the kingdom is. And secondly, it teaches us that the most important thing for us to do is to seek that kingdom. There's nothing else that is more significant in our lives than seeking the kingdom itself. And so you have an individual that as soon as he saw it, he hid it and went and sells all that he has so he can buy the land so he can have the treasure. And the other one, when he found that one pearl of great price, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. It indicates that we must give up everything for the Lord. That's the most important thing that doesn't matter what it takes, doesn't matter how great the sacrifice is. And again, these are things that are illustrated so often in Jesus' teaching. When Jesus talks about the division that would take place between father and son and mother and daughter, when individuals will become estranged from their own family because of the choices that they made. When in Luke, Peter talked about how we had left all to follow you, and the promise given concerning the great possessions and great reward that they would receive for that type of commitment. That kind of commitment is something that God requires of us, and it doesn't matter what it is. He had a rich young man who kept diligently the laws, but was told by the Lord to sell all that he has and give it to the poor and come and follow him. And he went away sorrowful because he had many possessions. He had something that he was unwilling to give up for the kingdom. And we can't do that. An individual who understands the nature and the value of the kingdom is an individual who will do whatever is required, whatever he has to do to gain that, because that's the most important, most valuable thing that he can possess. So very simple lesson there as well. Anybody want to enlarge upon that or add to it? Yes, Dave.
You know, on that verse I went about the hidden treasure there, I know a man that had four children and didn't know anything about the gospel, not even about the blood of Christ, or need to be saved. But he wanted his children, well, they should be in Sunday school, as they call it, and they go with them, and not just think, but go with them, you know. And then when you found out the truth, you know, and that was 64 years ago, or last Halloween, 5 ago. About 2 months before that time for it. But, I grew, you know,
So that's how you felt about that in your own life, is that you were doing something for your kids, not necessarily looking for something for yourself and stumbled across.
I don't know what that meant. I didn't know about baptism, but my wife was a member of church, but she was in.
What's wrong with
that? Wasn't that painful, but yeah.
That's interesting.
She was baptized and dunked in the water.
Yeah. That's neat. Yeah, that's something that you know. I guess when we all look back at the time of the events which lead up to our conversion, there is some special about that for us. And I appreciate your words there. We're almost out of time. Let's go and look at the parable of the dragnet very quickly. It's similar to the parable of the tares and the wheat. The kingdom of heaven's like a dragnet that was cast into the sea. This is verse 47. And it gathered some of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to the shore, and they sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but threw the bad away. And so it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth, separate the wicked from the just, cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. So there's the same exact picture. It's illustrated differently. One is wheat and tares, and the other is fish. Good fish and bad fish. Fish that's edible, fish that you would have to eat, fish that you throw away. But the dragnet is very much like that. The world is the field is the world. The dragnet is the world. And so in that gathering, in that harvest, the gathering of the fish, there is a distinction that is made between the good and the bad. And the same ending is told in both passages. In verse 50, they'll cast into the furnace of fire, there'll be wailing and gnashing of teeth. In that separation. And so we can assume as well, with regard to they gathered the good into the vessels, that would be similar to the statement that the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom in verse 43 of the text. So very good parallel. So you have the three parables. That's what, if you want to look at the construct of the chapter, in addition to the parable of the sower, you have the three double parables. The first ones, the parable of the mustard seed, 11, teach about the expansive nature of the kingdom and the power of the seed to expand the kingdom. The second two talk about the value of the kingdom and why we must put that first in our lives and make that the purpose of our possession. And then the third one, the parable of the tares, the parable of the dragnet, is a parable about judgment. And then in the end, there will be a winnowing out, and the righteous will be with God, and the wicked will be condemned in eternity. So those are the parables that are found in the text. That leads us to verses 53 through 58, but which we'll just make a note of. But anybody have any final comments, questions about the parables? All right. Well, I appreciate you letting me get through those fairly quickly. Looking at that rejection of Jesus in Nazareth, again, consider how what he's talking about. This is what the seed can do. This is if you got good and honest hearts, this is what can be accomplished. All these things being taught and the gospel being available to them. But when it came to pass, when Jesus finished the parables, he departed from there and went to his own country. So now he's talking to people who knew him, where he grew up in Nazareth. He taught them in their synagogue, and they were astonished. And they said in verse 54, where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? So they were evidencing, witnessing the works. They recognized that the significance of his teaching. But then in verse 55, he said, is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? His brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. We know him. His sisters, are they not all with us? Where did this man get all these things? And they were offended at him. That's something that just absolutely mind-boggling to me, that they were aware of him, but it was their very familiarity with him that caused their contempt, that they were offended with him, as indicated there in verse 57 of the text. So Jesus responded. His response in verse 57, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and his own house, and he did not do many works there because of their unbelief, many mighty works there because of their unbelief. So, it was, again, not a matter of incapacity, but an unwillingness. Keep that in mind, because that's a good lesson to be learned throughout the entirety of this chapter. Individuals who desire to hear the truth and to accept the truth, they will get it. They'll get what they need. God will supply it to them. But an individual who is going to allow any bias, whatever it may be, in this case it was that familiarity, we know this guy. We can't accept that he's this special guy because we saw him growing up. We've been around his family. We know who he is. And the idea that he was something special is something that caused them offense, and they were unwilling to accept it. And Jesus specifically did not do many works, mighty works. Now, we're told that they were aware of his mighty works in verse 54. So they were aware of what he could do, but he did not try to do those things in their presence because they were not willing to accept it. And so they were the ones at fault in that.
Mark says that the only miracles he did were to heal a few sick people.
Yeah.
So those were compassion.
Thank y'all very much. We'll pick up with chapter 14 next week. Mm-hmm.